First, it's our weekly roundup of some of the top stories out of the nation's capital. Mexico's president is in Washington to promote the renegotiated trade agreement with the U.S. and Canada, but there's no Canada in the picture today. And we learned Monday about where a lot of the Paycheck Protection Program money went. Some of the recipients surprised some people. Those are a few of the stories we'll be talking about, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you check out this list of loan recipients in this Paycheck Protection Program? What stood out to you? Did it go to you? Did your business benefit from it? If so, let us know and how it helped you, if at all. Or did you apply and didn't find success in getting that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Seungmin Kim is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Seungmin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this international visit. Now, with COVID, world leaders aren't always getting together all that much. Now, we've got Mexico's Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador at the White House today talking about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal going into effect. What's behind this visit? What are the interests on each side here?
There's actually been this visit has been really fascinating to watch. It's the second in a few weeks of a foreign leader visiting the White House, which a lot of international, as we know, has been stopped because of the coronavirus pandemic. But it comes at an interesting time. It's actually the Mexican president's first foreign trip, you know, into the United States or just anywhere outside Mexico as the Mexican president. So it is interesting that AMLO, as he is, you know, commonly called, would choose the United States as kind of his first place of his own foreign trip throughout his presidency. As we know, the president had made disparaging comments about Mexicans during his presidential campaign. He falsely repeatedly said that he would get Mexico to pay for a border wall, a promise that he clearly has not kept and has struggled to build the wall even. But the trade agreement that the both presidents touted today is something that has been a major, victory for both presidents. And actually, you know, all three presidents in the three countries that are involved. Canada's Justin Trudeau obviously did not choose to come to Washington today as part of this agreement, citing the pandemic. But you see how the Trump campaign has promoted this new trade agreement in their campaign messaging earlier today. This is expected to help, in those key Midwestern states where access to goods, especially for those farmers, is opened up. And so this is a key legislative win for the Trump administration. But as always, a lot of these victories do get overshadowed by the controversies of the day, whether it's the president's comments or his ongoing handling of the pandemic. So it's one of several things that the White House is grappling with at this moment.
And then, as I mentioned, the Paycheck Protection Program, the list of recipients released, 650,000 businesses and nonprofits, that list released by the Treasury Department, including the dollar amount range of the loans. A lot of people going through this with a fine-tooth comb, trying to figure out where the money went, who the recipients were. And they were all over the place, right? Like a lot of different kinds of businesses and groups here.
A lot of different kinds of groups and businesses, and a lot of different groups and businesses that you could make an argument perhaps shouldn't have gotten government assistance. So my colleagues at the Washington Post analyzed that data released Monday, and it showed that, you know, at least half a dozen businesses with ties to members of Congress who you remember wrote and voted on that legislation, and also the law firm that represented President Trump, were among the hundreds of thousands of firms that got this government-backed aid that was meant to protect small businesses. I think a lot of that data, which only really came after the public disclosure, only really came after a lot of public pressure from news organizations and various interest groups, I think will help guide Congress in the next round of coronavirus relief packages if they do want to expand this program, the Paycheck Protection Program, somewhat, because in their haste haste to write this emergency rescue legislation, you know, there are a lot of places that, you know, lawmakers say will need to be tweaked or, you know, qualified are requirements that will need to be revised. I think one interesting point was that nearly 90,000 companies in the program took the aid without promising, literally on their applications, that they would rehire workers or create jobs, which was the whole intent of the program, that they would keep workers on the payroll. We talked about the connection to members of Congress. There were also businesses with ties to members of the administration, whether it's the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, or Treasury Secretary Elaine Chao, that benefited from this program. Now, you know, spokespeople for them say they had no knowledge of those companies getting the assistance. But there are a lot of, you know, kind of these overlapping interests that we've seen just from this very, very vast, big program.
Does it look like anybody's trying to take names from this list and run with it as a political football at this point?
That's actually emerging in a lot of the Senate races, which obviously has been much a little bit more under the radar than, you know, about obviously the presidential campaign. But there are a handful of Senate Democratic candidates who had been a little bit critical of the Paycheck Protection Program, whether it's the disclosure requirements or whatnot. But after we saw the data released today, there were a handful of candidates who similarly had businesses that they had some sort of ties to benefit from the program. And Republican candidates and Republican senators have seized on that as, you know, hypocrisy of sorts. And I think it just goes to show that a program this vast, this wide, are going to have kind of these overlapping conflict or conflicts or a semblance or an appearance of conflict. And I think that's something that lawmakers are going to more closely watch in the future.
We're talking to Seungmin Kim from The Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's stay on those Senate races, Seungmin. You know, the presidential race, like you said, getting a lot of attention. But as happens every 2 years, a third of the Senate up for grabs. Wisconsin, we've got a bye week this time. We don't have either of our seats up. But give us the lay of the land. And Democrats have the minority in the Senate now. They need some pickups. What is the big picture here?
So big picture is Republicans are feeling very nervous right now about their prospects of retaining Senate control. It was always going to be not too easy for Republicans to retain control of the Senate. They do. They are largely playing defense. They hold 53 seats currently to the Democrats' 47. So, and there are a lot of Republican senators who are currently holding seats where either Hillary Clinton won in 2016 or the president won narrowly or are definitely considered swing states this time around. We're talking about Colorado and Maine, where Cory Gardner and Susan Collins are in tough reelection bids. And we're also talking about states such as Iowa, North Carolina, and Arizona, where the president won in 2016, but clearly are very competitive states, both on the presidential level and on the Senate level this time around. Republican senators are worried about a number of things, but a lot of the dynamics are similar to the president right now, with the focus so much on the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, to the sinking economy, to the president's handling of the racial and civil unrest that we've seen all over the country, and the other kind of the related controversies that the president seems to ignite, whether it's over Confederacy symbols or whatnot. The focus is so much on the party in power, and that's what's concerning Republicans right now. Another concerning data point for Republican senators is that there is a lot of enthusiasm on the grassroots level for Democratic candidates right now. You've had one Democratic challenger after another raise record-breaking sums in the second quarter of this year, which is the quarter that ran from April 1st to June 30th. There are Democratic challengers in red states such as Kentucky and South Carolina that are pulling in double-digit million-dollar sums, which are astronomical amounts. There are a lot of it powered by small dollars, which means, you know, donors can contribute again, and that Democrats, they really show this grassroots enthusiasm for getting Republican senators out of office.
Now, I know in the presidential election, Wisconsin is a favorite to be the key swing state in a close election. Is there a Senate seat or two that people are really looking at as a hotly competitive, the bellwethers for the whole thing?
There are a lot that you can choose from at this point, because if you think about it, obviously there is a Senate race in Alabama that is kind of the one race on the radar that Republicans are expected to pick up. But you're looking at a number of states, whether it's Maine or North Carolina or Iowa, that could be the tipping point for Democrats to get the 50 or the 51 or the 50 if Biden wins the presidency, that majority making state. So a lot of it focuses, you know, a lot of these senators are also in their first terms, with the exception of Susan Collins of Maine, who is a longtime veteran senator. You know, most of these Republicans who are in these competitive states are Republicans who won in that big class of 2014 that put Mitch McConnell as majority leader 6 years ago. So these are senators who don't have a lengthy record in Washington, who are still trying to introduce themselves to voters. And on top of the races that we discussed, another very interesting race to be watching is Montana, because we know that it's obviously a red state, a Trump-loving state. But Republican Senator Steve Daines there got himself a very formidable challenger when Governor Steve Bullock, who by virtue of being governor has shown that he can win statewide in a red state, got in the race earlier this year, even though he had said several times that during his short presidential bid that he would not run. But Bullock, because of his recognition statewide, his appeal to Trump voters, and his ability to fundraise a lot, has become a really, really, like I said, a formidable challenger to Senator Daines, and really put Montana on the map, which is remarkable in an election year.
We're talking with Washington Post White House reporter Seungmin Kim. It's the week in Washington. Coming up, we'll look at federal guidance on COVID-19 related issues, including what we're hearing from the White House and prominent Republican leaders on the issue of, should you wear a mask? Should you go to big events like political conventions? And what should happen with schools this fall? You can join in at 800-642-1234. When it comes to messages, maybe even policies related to COVID-19, what do you want to hear right now from the White House, from presidential candidates, from Congress? What kind of example do you want to see them set? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Washington Post White House reporter Seungmin Kim about some of the week's top stories out of Washington. Seungmin, you wrote about masks and leading Republicans kind of embracing the mask message, even as the president is not buying in wholeheartedly. What's going on?
So that's been one really interesting point of divide between President Trump and, frankly, the rest of his party. We know from public health officials and members of his own administration, medical experts, that putting a covering over your nose and mouth is one of the most effective ways of trying to contain the spread of the virus, especially as, you know, people, as the economy continues reopenings and people start to go out, try to kick the cabin fever that we've had over the last several months. But the president, for various reasons, several times has repeatedly said he would not, repeatedly refused to wear a mask in public. Now the White House has said that he is the most tested man in America, and I would say that's probably accurate, and that people around him are tested regularly for COVID, and that he doesn't need to be wearing a mask. But there's something that a president does, and that is to set an example for the rest of the public. And you've seen, especially with public opinion, very, you know, much in favor of, you know, wearing those protective coverings to stop the spread. You've seen other Republicans kind of step up this kind of public health message and urging the public to wear masks. I did find it interesting that even Vice President Pence does make it a point to regularly wear masks, whether it's at a press briefing or traveling, even if he does take it off to speak to reporters or for photo ops or whatnot. And some of the most most ardent, you know, advocates, proponents of wearing a mask have come from Republican senators. One in particular is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. When he's been back home, he's been repeatedly urging the public to wear a mask. He wears a Washington Nationals baseball mask on the Capitol at times. And he's really been emphasizing that he is a polio survivor. He has been focused on this. And you've seen a lot of Republican senators, whether through Twitter or Instagram, and also just in their public appearances, and then obviously just by their own actions, emphasize how important mask wearing is. And it really is a minority of lawmakers on Capitol Hill who regularly have not worn masks.
On a related note, we have some Republican senators say they're not going to the Republican National Convention, the part of it that's going to be in Florida. It's been a kind of a winding road here as to where this thing is going to be and how much is going to be in Charlotte, how much is going to be in Florida. But can you talk about some of the Republican senators saying they're going to sit this one out, especially with what's going on in Florida with COVID-19?
Definitely. I mean, one senator in particular who we're really looking as, you know, has really been a focus in terms of the coronavirus not being a reason for, or being a reason for him not being able to attend, is Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa. He is the second oldest member of the Senate. He is 86 years old. He has attended, obviously, many, many conventions in years past. He is not up for re-election this year, so he doesn't have to be home campaigning. But he says he's just not going to go. And you do have several other senators, for various other reasons, say they will, you know, not be attending. You know, Susan Collins, like we discussed earlier in the show, she is up for re-election, so she generally doesn't attend conventions if she is up for re-election. Senator Mitt Romney, who is probably the most prominent Trump critic among Republicans on Capitol Hill, won't be attending either. He didn't attend in 2016, so that's not too much of a surprise. But what's been interesting is the lack of response that we've been getting from Republican senators on whether they actually are attending. You know, in any other year, it probably would be a given that political figures as prominent as members of the U.S. Senate would attend their party's convention. But the fact that very few are kind of running out and confirming that they will indeed be in Jacksonville really underscores that concern, that public health concern that Republican senators have, or that of being in closed spaces or being in an area that is considered a COVID hotspot with a lot of other people. The president did kind of give himself an out in an interview earlier this week, saying he would be, quote, flexible with potential convention plans. But this has already been moved once from Charlotte, North Carolina, because of the COVID situation. And it is definitely, you know, nothing is assured at this point as to whether this convention goes off in a way that Trump wants, which is with the big pageantry and the thousands of people, which is the whole reason why this convention was moved to Florida in the first place.
We're talking to Seungmin Kim from The Washington Post, looking at the big stories in national politics today. I want to throw one more at you, Seungmin, that's been developing today. One of the big questions now with COVID-19 is when and how do schools reopen? We're going to talk about that with a Wisconsin pediatrician, by the way, on the show tomorrow at 4:30. The CDC had guidelines out. The president criticized them. Now Vice President Pence says the CDC is going to change the recommendations. Quoting Vice President Pence, he said, "We just don't want the guidance to be too tough." What are you watching with this, with the signals the White House is sending on school reopening?
I'm watching to see what sort of resources they're willing to provide to state and local governments to be able to reopen schools properly. And the fact is, you've heard estimates and different experts have talked about all the additional funding that schools would need to for extra staffing, for extra sanitation, to be able to have classes in the fall. So is the administration going to be able to be willing to kind of offer that extra funding to individual school governments? You know, we've seen comments from administration officials earlier today that they'd be withholding funding. Is that even legally plausible? What are the problems with the guidelines that the CDC laid out? I think those are all questions that the administration and particularly members of Congress will have to address in the coming weeks. Right now, members of Congress are back home in their districts during a two-week summer break, but they will come back later in July, and they will almost surely pass another coronavirus rescue package. And it is expected to be smaller in size than the $3 trillion CARES package that passed earlier this year. But a big focus of whatever passes Congress is how you deal with the school situation, how to get them safely reopened. Do they have enough resources, and do they have enough guidance from the federal government to be able to, you know, to be able to reopen properly. And that's a question that we don't quite know the answer to yet. But the discord between the president and his own administration, which we've seen a lot, was just remarkable today. Education and school reopenings has been a focus for the administration this week. But the fact that the president kind of goes out there and contradicts the CDC on Twitter, saying their guidelines are too tough and too expensive, and Vice President Pence kind of has to go in the press briefing later that day and says, yes, they were being revised after the president came out on Twitter and criticized the guidelines, it was a really remarkable move earlier today.
In our last few moments, Seungmin, probably the big story tomorrow is something we don't even know about yet, but what do you have your eye on right now?
Well, the one big thing to watch is something that we watch at the end of every June, which is what the Supreme Court is going to be doing. There's been a lot of blockbuster cases, whether it's on immigration, gay rights. You just had another big ruling on the Affordable Care Act and their contraceptive mandates today. But the Supreme Court is going to announce tomorrow morning whether Congress can see President Trump's personal financial records. We know that the president has not been fully as transparent as other presidents in terms of his tax returns, his financial records. But that is a case that has been waged all the way up to the Supreme Court. And tomorrow is the last day that opinions will be issued. So we know for sure that the decision on Trump's tax returns will come tomorrow morning. And that will be that whatever the court decides will definitely drive the news cycle tomorrow.
We'll watch for that. Seungmin, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Seungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. And again, more on schools tomorrow on Central Time.